I say this respectfully, Mr. Douglas. I always listen to your news updates.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear a single word of the one you did a few minutes ago. That's because Alex Bevin is here in studio with us, and Alex and I, we were just batting the breeze. We're having a good old time talking about Alex's background and just talking about some of the glory days here, and I totally lost track. You walked in here. Next thing I know, we had like 30 seconds left in that Fox Sports update, and I thought, oh, my God, we got to go. We got to get ready for the interview.
Sure.
Alex, it's a pleasure to have you in studio, man. How are you?
I'm great. Hey, it's good to see you guys. Matt, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Andy, how you doing, man? And it's great to be in downtown Elyria again. I haven't been here for a while, and, you know, it's coming along.
It is, yeah, looking good, especially when the sun's out burning my back up, coming through the window here about this time of day. My seat feels like it's about 7,000 degrees because the sun just magnifies through these windows. But neither here nor there, you're going to be performing at Lorain County Community College's Stocker Art Center January 12th and 13th. So for those who haven't seen you play, for those who don't know all about you, I'm just phrasing here what I'm reading from Lorain County Community College: those that attend enjoy an evening of musical joy and light improv, which I think is pretty fascinating. Now, having talked to you for the last 15 minutes or so, I see where the light improv comes in here, but how long have you been at this?
Well, I started playing professionally when I was in high school, you know, in an Irish band in the flats, that's a whole different story. But I started playing around Cleveland about 1971. But the short story is about 1975. I wrote a song called "Skinny Little Boy from Cleveland, Ohio." Come to chase your women and drink your beer. WMMS picked it up. It became a summer anthem. And that kind of started my career here locally, even though at that time I was traveling nationally, opening for the likes of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, oh, wow, which is now the Dirt Band, the Earl Scruggs Review, Pure Prairie League, and John Hartford. So there was a whole different circuit nationally than there is today. It was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. So that's kind of where I cut my teeth, you know. And as the years went on, I kept on writing. I decided that, you know, the traveling life wasn't for me. So I kind of settled down in northern Ohio, decided, you know, we got perfectly good Lake Erie Islands here. A guy can make a little money there in the summer beating on a guitar. Hey, we got the flats here. Hey, we got a bunch of little boat clubs along here. Hey, look at old McGarvey's, which is now Quaker Steak and Lube, you know. And so, you know, I just kept on playing. It was just breaking strings and having fun. And, you know, I'm very lucky that the people of northern Ohio have given me a way to tout my insanity.
So you've mentioned some of the stops you made along the way. You and I talked, you know, a few minutes before we came on the air, and you were telling me about some of your stops. Now, you've come back here. You've talked about all the places that you've lived, but ultimately you've come back here. Where are some of those stops? You were telling me earlier Nashville was one of those stops. Where all have you been before ultimately coming back to Ohio?
Well, when I first, you know, started working, I worked for Tree Publishing in Nashville for a while as a staff writer, which meant that in those days you took a draw of $50 a week. And this is in 1970, you know, so that was probably like about $150 now. And then third shift, I mopped floors at the Baptist Hospital. That was my day-night gig. And the rest of the time, we were all just trying to write the next best country song. But I wanted to play, and Nashville exports music. So I got on what they call the college coffee house circuit, and I started traveling along all these different colleges. And typically what we'd do is we'd go in and we'd play three or four nights in a dorm, you know, in a coffee house situation. Then in the student center, there would be a concert, or there'd be a major act that would come through, and I would get to be the opening act. Well, I got to know some of these guys, and through a guy named Ken Jurek at Corruptor Productions. What a name, Corruptor Productions. He hooked me up with these people in Denver, which was Athena Enterprises, and I worked for them for a couple years. And at that point, there was a guy you probably never heard of, Jim Buffett. He was on their, but wow, he was like at the top. I was at the bottom, you know. And so I worked there for a couple of years. And then when I started working with Pure Prairie League as their opening act, I was picked up by a company in Minnesota called Variety Artists International. And from there, you know, I would occasionally get a gig from the Belkins. You know, everybody was friends. It was not cutthroat. It was certainly not like The Voice or Star Search or anything. There were no three X's. Everybody was trying to help everybody else. And I was lucky because I felt right into the middle of stuff where, you know, I could work with someone like a Steve Goodman or a John Hartford or the Doobie Brothers or Billy Joel. And I could be that guy who walked on stage with one guitar and, you know, would sing songs that I made up and hopefully for 45 minutes entertain people and they wouldn't have to move gear. Once I started like having bands, I realized, oh, I can't be an opening act anymore. I got too much stuff.
When you're writing these songs and you're putting these things together, I don't think people have any idea how difficult that really is. And to your credit, you've done 23 records, correct? Original works. I mean, that's absolutely incredible.
Yes.
So
yes.
When you put pen to paper, you try and put these ideas together. Where do some of these ideas come from?
You know, I've been real lucky. My dad and mom taught me to read, you know. And
that's
so,
good.
Right?
Yes.
Good place
so,
to start.
Good start, yeah. No kidding.
So, you know, so I graduated from high school, and I knew I wasn't going to college immediately. I was ready to enlist in the Coast Guard because I thought I might be going to Vietnam otherwise. And it didn't work out. So I ended up working a factory job for a short period of time. And I didn't want to do that. But the whole time I was reading, you know, I'd read a lot of comic books. I'd read science fiction. I would read stuff about the natural world. And it became a passion to start writing little fun things, you know, what I thought were fun. And that with the guitar playing, I started weaving them into songs. And it was a great way to get a cheap date with a girl, you know, say, hey, you know, I've been working on this song. Can we maybe like go to a coffee house and, you know, I'll play you this song. And that's part of it, Bull, you know.
The ladies?
You know, hopefully some of our younger male listeners out there are taking notes right now, right?
Yeah.
I think that's something that still kind of rings true today.
Yeah, so, you know, that continued. And then when I was traveling, you know, you can't go and play a show and then go out and, like, burn the midnight oil and then drive 300 miles to another gig. So I stopped like hanging out in the bars on the road, and I would work at writing every night, and you know, I kept journals, and I gotta say, there was a songwriter, the guy who wrote The City of New Orleans, Steve Goodman, who was a friend, and really encouraged that, and that was something that he did, and I thought he walked on water, so I started doing it. So in the later 70s, when I was, you know, here in town and building a life, what I really started doing was looking for every avenue that I could to work in music. So I started doing a little advertising. I used to write jingles, and I met a couple of guys like Dick Woolley or Jim Brickman. You remember Jim Brickman?
Sure.
You know, the who's now doing a Christmas, or I guess a couple nights ago did a Christmas thing at the Palace in Cleveland.
Pretty good on the piano, yeah.
Yeah, I sang a few commercials for him
in
the day. And then somehow I got picked up by SeaWorld in Aurora, and that's where all of a sudden I got very serious about being able to say, okay, you hand me an idea, and I'm going to turn that into a song. So it went from making songs that were completely all about passion and all about me to how can I translate your idea into something. And somewhere along the line, I don't know where it was, I realized that there were some parts of me that were for sale and some parts that were very personal and some that were my commercial product.
Mm-hmm.
So I started viewing myself kind of like a general contractor as opposed to a musician, you know. So I started about 1980, and about the time that I was getting serious about raising a family, you know, I'm going like, you know, I better turn this into a business or I'm going to be a bartender somewhere. And I got nothing against bartenders.
Sure.
Understood. Yeah.
Now, I was just going to ask. I mean, bringing it back to Cleveland, when you hear about people in the music industry, everyone's trying to move out to L.A. You mentioned you were in Nashville. At what point did you realize, I can do this back home in Cleveland and make a legit career out of it?
It was when I was probably about 1975 when I realized that I was going into different markets.
Mm-hmm.
I was well established on the college coffee house circuit. I was kind of breaking into the opening act market there. And I realized that I had to have a center. If I was going to be a songwriter, I had to have a center. I couldn't write from a hotel forever. I don't mind traveling. I enjoy traveling. My wife and I have a little camper that last year we went to Colorado. We went to New England, you know, out for a couple weeks at a time. But I'd love that. But if you're working and you're traveling, it's a whole different pressure. You know, Bull and I were talking about, you know, when you're riding on the bus with the team, you know, it's a whole different level of concentration. And it's also, you know, what you're doing socially is different, you know, because you're working together as a team, you know, and everybody plays off everybody else. You don't have that time to just look at yourself and say, okay, I want to write this. I hope I answered your question.
No, that makes sense. And you hear a lot of songwriters especially, too, talk about how songs are like their children. Is there one song in particular that you appreciate maybe a little bit more, that, or is it that same concept that, you know what, it's hard to pick just one?
It's usually the one I'm working on.
Okay.
I've been, I just finished an album. You can go to my website. It's alexbevin.com. Everybody knows how to do that. But an album called True Meridian. That is all very personal songs, and songs about my wife, my mom, my dad, my family, something everybody has. But I'm trying to relate those common experiences in a way that if you listen to that song, you'll go, oh, there's parts of me in there. You know, so that's the personal stuff. But I still like writing real goofy stuff, you know.
It's got to be the fun stuff, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, the other morning I had like one too many cups of coffee, and I opened up the laptop, and I wrote a song for my friends on Put-in Bay on the Miller Ferry. And if you go to my Facebook page, it's a public page, there's a little Christmas song to the guys on the Miller Ferry line. You know, and it's already got 6,000 hits. I'm going like, well, that's awful cool.
6,000 hits already. That's pretty darn impressive. Again, we're talking with Alex Bevin. He's performing at Lorain County Community College's Stocker Art Center on January 12th and 13th. And, boy, we've covered a lot of ground here, too, but I wanted to open the door a little bit back to the traveling conversation that you and I were having before. I thought it was hysterical, too. You were telling some of the stories about some of the things that you guys do just in order to kill some time. Because, as you said, you know, when you're on that bus with everybody, I mean, look, it's different when you're doing it for your own personal benefit, and it's different when you're doing it because you're traveling for business. If you could, share some of those stories, you know, well, like the camaraderie, the cool stuff that goes along with it.
A lot of it's, you know, boys with toys, you know, pranks that, you know, Not to the point of, like, you know, like being in a locker room where you snap the towel and you get the guy in the butt, but you might take a little super glue and accidentally super glue a guy's guitar picks to his amplifier.
Excuse me. Wow.
See, that sounds hilarious. I think there's a lot of creativity involved.
Or you might be in a Perkins and the guy goes to the John and you fill up his coffee cup with syrup and put a little cream in there so that it looks just like that.
Some thick coffee.
Yeah, you know, there's all kinds of things. You know, the other thing is, you know, retying someone's shoes, but only one shoe, you know. Just stuff that we did when we were young just for fun. And, you know, if I don't know if you're into hunting or fishing, but I got guys that I go fishing with. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them, they got pranks that are just out the wazoo. It's like there's one friend of mine who's got like this sticky stuff that he will put on a lure. And so you'll be changing out a lure, you know, and so you'll be dragging for a while and you'll pick it up and you go, oh no, Mike got me again, you know. You know, and it becomes funnier. It's kind of like that joke that somebody tells, that you got a buddy who tells a joke, and you know it's coming at a party because you've heard this joke. He starts telling it, and you can see all the people watching to see how the newbie reacts to the punchline. So, you know, but back in those days, you know, we probably the only time we got real malicious was I was out with the Outlaws, and there was this guy, God rest his soul, his name was Fred Franchi, and he was a genius. He was the funniest guy in the world. So he got, like, the band guitar tech to, like, you know, rewire And this guy was like a genius. In Cincinnati, he rewired one of the elevators so that when you hit ground, it went to two.
Oh, geez.
and then he fixed it later on. But we sat in the lobby, and we were just like watching. We were like bad pennies, you know. you hear like people, getting like super high and throwing, I threw the TV out the window. We never did anything like that. Probably the worst thing we did was like we killed brown whiskey bottles, maybe drank a little too much beer. Occasionally, all we wanted to do was like have a good time.
Wow.
That's life on the road, man. It's all good, funny stuff. It's all good, fun stuff as long as nobody gets hurt. I want to reference something. There was a Cleveland.com article on you a couple of months ago. I thought it was pretty interesting. They did a nice job of going through True Meridian, which you referenced once already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about the creation behind this album, because what's discussed in the article is that you capture the magic of what's considered a house concert in the recording. For those that aren't really familiar with what that is, how do you believe you captured that?
My goal was, even though I have worked in a lot of studios, my goal was to make the recording sound like I was sitting across my kitchen table, you know. So that was what I wanted to make it, a conversation. I wanted at the end of you listening to that to it have a cohesiveness. So it started out with a simple thought, and it 1 hour later you went, wow, I've been on a little journey there. So it turned out it was a little harder than I thought, because it was just me and a guitar, not a lot of gear, a very high-tech recorder. A friend of mine at Audio Technica, Steve Savanu, loaned me a couple of microphones that I could never afford. But, you know, they picked up like every little mistake and every little nuance that was sounding like a clam. So, you know, I had to kind of relearn a little bit of how to record. And it was very organic. It was a learning experience for me, because I'm so used to going on stage, you know, and when I walk on stage, you know, the performance light goes on. It's like Bull, when you hit that, you know, we're on the air button, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, just you're bringing something. Well, I had to bring everything way back. I had to slow things down a little. I had to remember that person on the other side was hopefully going to be listening without a lot of competing noise, or maybe they were listening through headphones, but it was communicating through that. So a friend of mine who works, her name is Holly Gleason. Oh, and she has a book out, which you can probably get. It's called Women Walk the Line, which is about country music. She works for Kenny Chesney. But she said, just imagine someone you know and you're singing to them, you know, but make it somebody that you can't see anymore. So, of course, you know, one of the people was John Bassett from Cleveland. You know, one of the person that I was singing to was, of course, Steve Goodman. You know, one of the persons was, Rita Coolidge, who, you know, I met Odetta. You know, so all these people, and that seemed to like turn the corner on it. But there was still a great deal of work that had to go into that. And that's what I'm hoping to bring to the Stalker performance. But aside from that, so I'm going to start just not to give away a spoiler mm-hmm. or anything about the performance, but I'm going to start with some of the new stuff. But then I'm going to transition back into 1975, 1976, and I'm going to bring a couple of my old guitars. And there's my old Martin D28 that has only been at one show in 25 years, and that was down at the Kent State Performing Arts Center in Tuscarora. And so it's coming to Stalker. It's not the one that I have at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't think they'll let me pull that one out.
I think that one's in stock. Got to pull some strings to get that one out of the glass,
yeah,
right?
I think that one's like there. But and the old guitar, you know, with just a microphone, and I want the audience to see kind of how it was. So then I'm gonna kind of bring them all the way back up and kind of hopefully go through about 30 years of music and writing. We tried it about a month and a half ago at the Kent State Performing Arts Center in Tuscarora County, and it it worked wonderfully. I'm so excited to have this opportunity, and I want to thank the people at the Stocker Arts Center for inviting me, because this is the way to start off my year.
Very cool stuff. Well, again, that's a nice little tease as to what you'll see if you go out there to the Stocker Arts Center at Lorain County Community College, January 12th and 13th. Alex, this was awesome. Yeah. This was a heck of a lot of fun. Looked up at the clock and saw what time it was. Feels like this interview's only been going on for like 3 minutes. This is a lot of fun, man. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, my pleasure. I'll come back anytime. Nice to meet you guys. You know what? We got lots of stuff happening around Northern Ohio. I hope you come and spend a night with me.
Absolutely. Again, you get two opportunities to do so, January 12th and 13th.